Hi, I'm Diane Shannon. I'm an internal medicine physician, award-winning writer, and certified coach. I learned the hard way about the cost of burnout, and in the 20-plus years since, I have dedicated my life to addressing physician burnout. I run a coaching company where I help women in medicine navigate the stresses inherent in the profession and the additional challenges that they experience. Join me as I investigate the underlying causes of the higher burnout rates in women and what we can do about them, individually and collectively. We can banish burnout and thrive as women in medicine. Welcome to this episode of Vital Signs, Thriving as a Woman in Medicine. Today, my guest is Dr. Paul Deschamps, a healthcare thought leader who spent 25 years as a family physician and 5 years as CEO of a large physician practice in California. There, he led a five-year transformation on the theme of returning joy to patient care. His areas of expertise are physician engagement, leadership coaching, management system and culture improvement, and physician burnout prevention. I met Paul in 2015 when we were introduced by a mutual colleague who knew we were both passionate about addressing physician burnout. We agreed to write a book together and spent the next 15 months researching and writing, Preventing Physician Burnout, Curing the Chaos, and Returning Joy to the Practice of Medicine. It was a complete pleasure working with Paul, and we've collaborated on many projects in the years since. Paul, I'm so happy to chat with you today about leadership and organizational culture and the ways that these affect the risk of burnout for everyone in medicine, no matter their gender. Welcome, Paul.
It's great to be here, Diane. And you're absolutely right. You know, our collaboration has just been so helpful and meaningful to me over the years as well. So I'm very happy to be here.
Great. So I'd like to start with a warm-up question. Mm-hmm. I know that you recently moved from Northern to Southern California. What is one thing that surprised you about your new location?
So in actuality, we're in Central California.
Oh,
Central,
sorry.
California, not SoCal. NorCal people and SoCal people are very different. And we're kind of a mix here in the Central Coast. I'm near San Luis Obispo and Pismo Beach. I think just the pace of life and the friendliness of the people here has been really something. It's a very special place. We feel pretty fortunate. We came here because our daughter went to college here and never left after she started here 13 years ago. And we thought, well, it's a nice place. Let's go. So.
Sounds excellent. And I actually have visited there, but it's been many years. And I remember it as being a very beautiful, peaceful place.
Yeah, we feel pretty fortunate.
So, Paul, let's dive in. And both of us feel so passionately about addressing physician burnout. But where do you want to start?
I think the area you're talking about with the management system issues. Many, you know, a lot of people work on the personal resilience and trying to help improve folks. And certainly you do great work there. The other big area of issue is practice efficiency. And there's a lot of folks working on that. I do believe that there's a real opportunity now with the changes in technology to truly address getting rid of a lot of the stupid stuff. You know, that discussion, we spend 2/3 of our time on wasteful work, 1/3 of our time on meaningful work. I think we now have the opportunity, if there's courageous leadership, to actually flip that ratio and get us to the point where we're spending 2/3 of our time on meaningful work, which would be transformative for the clinical experience, for the physician, and for everyone involved in the process.
So I want to pause for right 1 minute and what you said. Why would it take a courageous leader to make that transition? What about courage is it going to take to flip that?
Well, that's a great lead into this whole issue of leadership and the impact on burnout, because leaders are under so much pressure to perform, to hit targets that are set for them by a board or some other entity. And when you're feeling that much pressure, quite often it's harder to take a big risk. And yet really what we need to do these days is invest make some significant investments in improving practice efficiency by building a team around the physician, by bringing in technology that actually works and bringing it in a way that's very helpful by really carefully integrating it into the workflow. That requires stepping back a bit and actually for a short while, decreasing some productivity in order to have the capacity to design all of this correctly. And the pressure to be productive right now is huge. So many healthcare systems are struggling with their margins. And the thought of stepping back a little from that treadmill in order to then get better and be able to actually be more effective while you're running on that treadmill is, or find a different way to get forward instead of running on a treadmill, it's tough to take that risk to slow down. You know, the new things are not yet proven, so you've got to have a strong belief in it. And leaders who lead change are advocating for something very different. They're often leading people into something they haven't done before, so they are unsure, and there's no absolute guarantee it's going to work. Whereas just doing things the same old way, command and control management, no one's going to argue with you with that because it's known.
Right. So in the traditional form of leadership, you're not sticking your neck out to do something different and to try something different.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, and it reminds me of that analogy of trying to change the tires on your car while you're driving, right? You kind of have to stop for a period to do it right, but that means stopping.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Or, you know, the seven habits of highly effective people that sharpen the saw, you know, to stop and actually take the time to make that saw sharp so you can then work far more effectively. You know, it's absolutely vital. And I, you know, and very many leaders struggle with that. And I understand it because there is this pressure to keep producing. And if you miss, you know, your numbers for certainly for a year, but even for a quarter or a month, that raises a lot of concerns for people around you and above you.
And Paul, I know you have a really deep understanding of the drivers of burnout for physicians and others in healthcare. Can you elaborate some on that?
Sure. This is, you know, I had the great fortuitous pleasure to meet Christina Maslach and actually talk deeply with her about her the theories and philosophies that she developed around burnout. And she identified the three manifestations of burnout that are well accepted now: exhaustion, cynicism, and that sense of inefficacy. But she also identified six drivers of burnout and linked those drivers to those manifestations of burnout. And the most common one most people think about is work overload. The first driver of burnout drives exhaustion. Kind of a no-brainer. Everybody gets it. And most people think that's it. That's what burnout is. But in reality, the other five drivers of burnout that she identified are a lack of control, which is a big deal to us as physicians, it should be, insufficient reward and recognition, which has become a bigger issue these days, I think, particularly with the challenges dealing with patients who may not believe science any longer, or we get into all these political battles. Breakdown of community. We're all working so hard, we don't even have time at lunch to talk to each other. And yeah, I use the example of going into a hospitalist room in a hospital and seeing, you know, anywhere from 4 to 8 hospitalists there, none of them interacting with each other because they're busy interacting with the EHR. The next is absence of fairness. And here I think there's two issues. One is the macro absence of fairness, that the job we all signed up for is not what the job is today. It really feels like a bait and switch. And the second is more of a micro absence of fairness, in which you may not be properly rewarded or honored for the contribution you're making because of things you have no control over, such as your gender or race, country of origin, or sexual orientation. I'm not the best person to speak about this as an old straight white guy, but it's very clear that this is a huge issue, and it's things I've had to learn about it personally to understand it better. And then lastly, values conflict, the whole issue of moral injury when we're having to witness or act in ways that violate our personal values, or our values don't align with the organization in which we're working. So those five drivers, control, reward, community, fairness, and values, those directly impact cynicism And they really have all to do with how you lead and manage, whether you're leading a small team in your office of two or three people or leading a system of 20 to 30,000 employees. If people, when we really think about and understand those drivers and focus on how we can mitigate them, we can go a long way in improving engagement and helping people feel fulfilled in their work.
Paul, as you said that, I had this picture of two different physicians coming in to lead their team for a day, right? And one of them is filled with cynicism because of all the things you mentioned and just cannot possibly give the team hope that there's possibility for better workflow, working together as a team, all of those pieces that would make the workday and the interactions with patients so much better. Right. So that's one experience. Then there's this other physician who is not suffering from that those same burnout drivers and has that hope and that ability to bring the hope to the team that the possibility of improvement exists. And I just when you described it, I just had this flash of seeing the two contrasts and how different the experience would be then for their team, their clinical team.
Yeah, that's a really cool insight. And I hadn't really thought about it quite from that angle before. But you're right. Burned out leaders are end up being pretty toxic leaders. And the rate of burnout in C-suites now is equal to the burnout level in physicians. It did not used to be that way. Back when we first got together, CEOs had the same burnout rates as about the general population. But now their pressures are so great that they're burning out at the same level. But then that only compounds all of these challenges within the organization that way. And it's really harder to make a good decision, if you're already cynical as a CEO.
Right. And I imagine that drives as well the rapid turnover of the C-suite, which has been a problem for years anyway, right?
Right. It absolutely does drive that, and that the CEO job has become increasingly more challenging, no question. I do think, and it's, and I love, I do, I talk a lot about the C-suite and CEO level issues. I think maybe for the audience listening here, it's good to just think about my direct supervisor or manager as well, because that person has such an impact on my personal experience. The person I report up to is the most important person in terms of my experience and even my level of cynicism with those other five drivers.
Is there anything more you want to say about the problem, so that we understand it better before turning to solutions?
In order to, the most important thing is to get us the opportunity to spend most of our time doing meaningful work, which is improving practice efficiency. To get there, we need that leadership approach that does empower us and align us. I like to say, as a practicing family physician for 25 years, I wanted the empowerment to fix stuff that was wrong in my office. And then I became CEO with 300 doctors in my group, and the thought of all 300 being empowered and autonomous to fix things the way they wanted scared me that we'd fall apart from entropy. So it became really tempting to micromanage, but there's this way to empower and align, and that's the way that leadership can work, and maybe that's what we talk about
When
next.
you say align, Paul, can you define how you mean that? Because that the word is used a lot in different settings. So what do you mean by align?
Yeah, well, this is where the most doctors and myself included at first didn't really think much about mission, vision, and values. It's like, okay, that's nice corporate speak, but who really cares? But if we deeply understand the values and share and recognize those values that we collectively hold as important, that actually bring meaning to our work, and we actually, when most organizations have this performance dashboard, a system dashboard that they're looking at things like quality, safety, patient experience, financial performance, the experience of the workers, those metrics actually, if they're done right, align to our values. And they're really a way that we're demonstrating our honoring of those values. And then we can build actually efforts to improve performance to drive the system level outcome metrics by changing the process metrics, the processes we use in our day-to-day work that help drive improvement along those lines. And because we all do value quality, we value safety, you know, we value having a financially stable organization. We value having an experience as a worker that works well. But tying those together, understanding, you know, yes, I want to do improvements. How does those fit into the way the impact it has on my colleagues and my organization? And thinking through that as a team makes a world of difference.
Can you think of a specific kind of workflow change that an organization might do as a team, and what you've seen in terms of how that worked out?
Well, specific workflow changes, yeah, that's where building a team around the physician, the class for people who are familiar with team care medicine or that concept, so that the physician is spending time doing the things that they're most qualified and most people, other people cannot do. You know, the things that really bring us joy, being able to deeply connect with a patient who's willing to share with us their hopes and fears, or do a procedure that relieves suffering or saves lives, or mentoring young people preparing to become our colleagues, focusing and spending some time dedicated to improving workflows and, you know, doing research, improving healthcare. Those are the meaningful things. And we spend 2/3 of our time doing non-meaningful work that others would actually find meaningful. You know, if our front desk people are organizing and getting our schedules managed well, if our MAs or nurses were working together as a team and they're doing the things that we don't need to be doing, we're all experiencing something that we find fulfillment in. So that's really key, I think, in this process. To get that efficiency, to experience that, that's where, yeah, we need to redesign workflows in order to do that.
So it sounds like a big piece of it is team-based care. Right.
It is. And the challenge these days is there's no staff available to be on the team, which is why technology advances, AI and so like, you know, natural language processing, speech recognition, the ambient technology to listen in a room and create a note and orders for you has so much potential. And really, we're just at the point where software and hardware have the capability to make a difference for that.
Paul, what are some ways that we can take these concepts and ideas and implement them without taking on a huge wholesale transformation of the entire organization and its culture? Like, where could we start?
Yeah, no, that's really an important question, because that's what everybody's struggling with these days. We had one client we worked with where they wanted us to fix the workplace, really help fix the workplace. Talked about redesigning workflow. We went into their offices and talked about the processes it would take. And they said, you know, we don't have the time or staff to do that. We'd love to do that, but we just don't have it. So we looked at doing huddles instead. And it was amazing. First of all, it did not require the wholesale stepping back and redesign. It was relatively easy to implement. We did spend 1 week with a small team designing the huddle to be appropriate for that organization and that site, but it didn't require massive time off of work. And then the huddle itself, an effective huddle, has a few key components in it that do address the drivers of burnout. Good huddles start with some reward and recognition, thanking somebody on the team for something they did that really helped and made a difference. That's that recognition and reward component, and it starts the meeting positively. Next is dealing with overwork, with capacity and demand. Quite often you look at the schedule or the census, that's the demand coming at us, and we don't have the capacity with staff, equipment, supplies, or time to really handle it all. And when we don't, at least then we can build a contingency plan at the start of the day so it doesn't overwhelm us quite so badly or surprise us and, you know, throw us off track in the middle of the day. The next step then is to actually look at performance metrics. And this is, and the particularly the process metrics that happen in the office itself.
Can you give some examples of what those process metrics would be?
Yeah. So things like, if we're, if our value is quality, and in a primary care office, that means making sure all of the preventive and chronic disease management tests and immunizations, et cetera, are up to date. That's work that we can check on with each patient where all of these addressed. And if so, great. And if not, then raise the question, what do we need to do differently? How can we change what we're doing so we are capturing all those? That's a process metric doing that work, but it ends up in a quality and an outcome metric for quality of, lower A1Cs or whatever it might be that you're focused on at the time. And when you're not hitting those, then it's time to solve that problem. Why are we not hitting it? And how can we do it better? And the other problem solving that happens in a huddle is a problem that the little things that drive you crazy, we call them the pebbles in your shoe. You open a drawer, what you need isn't there. You go to the printer, it's out of paper. You're running all over the hospital trying to find a wheelchair, whatever it might be. I remember just being so frustrated, and I'd swear I wasn't ever going to let that happen again. And by the end of the day, so many other things had happened, I'd forgotten about it till it happened again a week later. By taking that little irritation and putting it on the huddle board for the team to discuss the next morning, the team can come together and say, okay, is this a problem everybody's having? If so, do we want to have a couple people work on it and come back to us with some solutions we can try to implement and gradually remove those little pebbles one at a time? That whole process actually, so when you think about the drivers of burnout and how all these things fit together, and not only do we start with reward and recognition with the thanking people at the front, but we deal with work overload, we deal with values conflicts. And then in the problem solving, we're looking at control. We're building community by working together to address these things. And it starts to feel less unfair because the things that are frustrating to us are actually being addressed instead of having to deal. And we have that local control as opposed to just having to deal with edicts from above, which certainly feels like they happen way too often. When we implemented this, we had an agreement with this organization. We'd put do six huddles, get six huddles started in six locations in 3 months. They were so popular right out of the gate that it within 3 months we'd implemented in 14 sites, and a year later, 15 months later, we were implemented in 105 outpatient offices. The first office that went live, they went from a 40% turnover rate of staff to 0% the first year. The fact the first week, one of the staff members came up to the manager and said, I was ready to quit. And then you started these huddles, and I feel like people are listening to me. I feel like I'm part of a team. I want to stick around and see what happens. So these are so powerful. And they can, certainly physicians can be kind of cynical about them at the first place, and I understand it. But they launched properly and carefully, deeply engaging the team members and having everybody collaborate. They're so powerful. They really make a difference.
How long do these take? And how do you get people in the right place at the right time together to do a morning huddle?
Yeah, they should never be more than 15 minutes. A lot of people say we should do a 5-minute huddle. 5 minutes is too tight, I think, to really do all of that together. So maybe 10 minutes if you get good at it. Even when we're starting and we're learning, if we don't cover all that agenda in 15 minutes, we still stop at 15 minutes because this cannot become something that consumes half the morning. And we'll get better and we'll learn how to do it. When do you do it? That really varies office by office. You want to have as many people there as possible. You also don't want to disrupt the flow of the clinical processes. Doing it in the middle of a morning, I've had sites experiment with that, and usually they end up abandoning that because it's too frustrating to keep the workflow going. Do people come in a little early? Do you just cancel that first patient of the day? Block that schedule for that time? Do you do it over the lunchtime or at the end of the day? Every office, I think, has to figure out what works best for them and the way that their schedules work, so that you can get the most people there and that it can be relevant. But it's more important. The principles are more important. Have as many people there as you can. Do it daily. Keep it short. And then follow those guidelines to really address those drivers of burnout.
I love that you have seen a very concrete result, which is reduced turnover. And that has been such a stressor for so many physicians when there is this high turnover among the staff.
Oh,
And
yeah.
you're just getting to know your MA and they've left, and then you have a whole new person to work with. So that's really encouraging.
Yeah, it's and it's understandable, and it gets to the point if your MA keeps turning over, you start to become cynical yourself and don't want to invest as much energy into having that MA feel welcomed and as part of the team. So it can become a pretty vicious cycle, for sure. Most physicians are leaders of a small team themselves. The people, even that if they have one or two support people that work with them. So really building that team is important, and that thinking through those drivers of burnout with your micro team and understanding the impact that you have as a physician is pretty important.
Paul, is there any of this from your experience? And I know you have a daughter who is a physician. Is there any of this that relates specifically to women in medicine and what might be helpful to them?
So many things actually. The absence of fairness, I think, is the biggest one, where on a couple of fronts, certainly women physicians are passed over for promotion and further opportunities more than men are, which is no rational basis to it. In fact, we know women physicians actually provide better care, in most cases, get better outcome than most men on average. So that's a big issue. Secondly, I know your audience understands this completely, but the whole factor of the work after work, women go home and are expected, in most cases, whether verbalized or not, to do most of the household duties. And so they've got a whole extra job. I sometimes joke, and I don't know if it's really appropriate or not, that most women doctors need a wife just to be able to, keep their the entire life going effectively, because it is a whole other issue that often doesn't get talked about enough.
And is there anything in what you've described in terms of the huddle or change in workflow or change in culture that would be especially helpful for women in medicine?
I base a lot of my work on the concepts of lean, and most people think lean is about, some efficiency expert coming in and telling you what to do and what not to do. In reality, it's the first principle of lean is respect for people, and then helping bring have people with their great ideas contribute their ideas and improve things. And that respect is so important. And again, I think it's an issue where it's easier for myself as a man to get that respect than as a woman in our society, in our healthcare culture, medical culture. So that, I think that's really important to understand and realize. And I'd like to think that things are starting to change, but I think we also have a long way to go.
Great. Paul, do you have a last piece of advice that you'd like to pass on to our listeners?
I think understanding the opportunity and impact that you have in your practice with your micro team of people that you work with, whether you've got a team of peer physicians or people who report up directly to you, what you say, what you do, how you act throughout the course of the day, how you react to issues that come up in the context of those drivers of burnout, the overload, control, reward and recognition, community fairness and values. Just that being aware in the background of your mind, how you respond to things and what that impact is going to have long term on the people that are working directly with you. And being aware if your supervisor is honoring them, being appreciative of that, and if not, understanding what's going on. So at least you have a way to think about it rationally. I know, and I think back my, if I was 30 years younger, starting into all this again, I would behave very differently. Well, we get acculturated into in medical school into being, these tough people, and particularly for the physician audience, everybody's familiar with how our culture in medical training is really toxic. And I talk to lay people, and I'll use the term getting pimped on rounds, and they're terribly offended. And for all of us, it's just second nature. We know what that means. It's not acceptable. It's been considered acceptable from when we were fresh new med students, and so we've kind of accepted it. I think we're just now starting to, that's starting to change. And even that term is a pretty darn sexist term when you think about it. It's really bad.
Absolutely. Paul, what is the best way for listeners to get in touch with you?
On my website, there's contact information, or if you really want to talk to me, you can schedule a 15 or 30 minute talk. My email is paul@pauldechantmd.com, so you can find me there. I'm on LinkedIn, and I've recently gotten onto TikTok, of all places. I'm finding that it's there's a lot of physicians, a lot of good stuff happening on TikTok, and as much as people worry about, Chinese influence and all that, it's certainly, I think it's a pretty good platform for communicating ideas and things, and you could reach me there as well.
Excellent. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Paul Deschamps, for joining me today on this episode of Vital Signs, Thriving as a Woman in Medicine. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Diane.